You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn about the steps the state wants to take to address issues surrounding Alzheimer's and dementia.
First, when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of legalized same-sex marriage in 2015, it was a major victory for gay and lesbian rights in the United States. And public support for same-sex marriage is at an all-time high. The latest polling from the Pew Research Center finds that more than half of Americans support same-sex unions.
Well, our next guest acknowledges that we live in an era of considerable advancement and change for LGBT rights. He says that gay, lesbian, and transgender citizens are still too often considered less than whole and are still lacking full legal protections against workplace, housing, family, and other kinds of discrimination. And as we saw in the wake of the mass shooting at a gay club in Orlando this past weekend, there's still anti-gay prejudice to be found in the United States.
Stephen Engel joins us now. He's associate professor and chair of politics at Bates College. He's also an affiliated scholar at the American Bar Foundation. His new book is Fragmented Citizens, The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's go back to early 2015. Public support for same-sex marriage was at a record high, more and more states legalizing it, and the Supreme Court was getting ready to have the final say. Yet, as you say, it was still a disorienting season for gays and lesbians in the United States. What else was happening around that time that spoke to this idea of less than whole citizenship?
Well, I think, you know, on the eve of the Obergefell decision, which, of course, was that decision that declared bans on same-sex marriage unconstitutional, you have, and I use a vignette to open the book, about tax season, right? And so when you're filing your taxes as a same-sex couple, prior to Obergefell, in some states you are recognized as married, in some states that might carry forward for the federal recognition, but in other states that would not be the case. Or, for example, if you celebrated your wedding in a state, the federal government that recognized it, the federal government would recognize it, but that might leave some others out. And so you had to file multiple types of tax returns. And so the state would essentially render your relationship apart in the tax filing. There were some other issues going on. This was about the same time that there were some Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that were coming down the pipe in Arizona and then later in Indiana that were attempting to curb recognitions of LGBT equality in favor of First Amendment rights of religious expression. And so you had this tension between equality that followed from the 14th Amendment versus religious expression that might follow from the First Amendment. And then, of course, that gets tangled up in a lot of discourse about the ways in which companies and firms would either bring business into a state or not, depending on what their approach to LGBT equality was. And so I think it was disorienting for all of these reasons. In part, I think, even after Obergefell, the status of gays and lesbian citizens is disorienting, and this is the theme I explore in the book, precisely because it is contingent on the governing issue in which you as a citizen are interacting. So, and on the issue. So, for example, if I were married, that relationship might be recognized by the federal government or by the state, but I might live in a state that doesn't recognize my status to, say, equal employment or equality in public accommodations. And so depending on the policy issue, the status of my citizenship, of my equality, is rendered unequal or fragmented.
So you've touched on a few of those, but let's look more closely at some of those big areas where inequalities and legal discrimination are still present. So you mentioned the workplace. What are some of the issues for gay and lesbian people in the workplace and having workplace protections?
Right, certainly. Well, there is, in fact, no ban on discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity in terms of workplace discrimination in over 25 states. There's also no ban on discrimination in public accommodations on gender identity or sexual orientation in over 25 states. Now, this has actually been a very interesting moment. What I mean by that is that there is, in fact, no law, federal law, that, like, say, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that includes sexual orientation or gender identity as a specific category that is protected from discrimination. So if you were to look at the 1964 Civil Rights Act, it mentions things like race, sex, color, creed, etc., and sexual orientation as a phrase is not in there. More recently, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has ruled that sexual orientation and gender identity might be covered under the concept of sex. This has been a concept that legal theorists have played with for over 20 years, that, for example, sex discrimination or sexual orientation discrimination, to take one example, is actually a version of sex discrimination. Because what we're saying when we're discriminating against someone who is gay or lesbian, we're saying that that person, precisely because they have romantic feelings for someone of the same sex, is violating a sex stereotype. Mm. And violations of sex stereotypes are, in fact, a form of sex discrimination or you know, not conforming. The expectation that one conform to a sex stereotype is a form of sex discrimination.
Another aspect that you address in the book, and you kind of touched on it in an interesting way with tax returns. So one of the things that people often do on a tax return is claim a dependent, a child, and adoption, and also being able to have two same-sex parents listed on a birth certificate, for example, and all the rights that come with that. That is also something that is not guaranteed for same-sex couples.
Oh, yes. I mean, the status of second-parent adoption or step-parent adoption for same-sex couples, it very much varies by state. There have been some definitive laws that said, you know, bans on same-sex adoptions, and in most cases, those absolute bans have most recently been struck down. But it still does leave the status of same-sex parents, whether two parents of the same sex can be listed on the birth certificate, is still a very gray area, and it does depend in the jurisdiction state by state. So to make this sort of like a very real situation, I have a very good friend who went on the academic job market a few years ago, and he and his husband, and they have two children, and they were restricted in their job search after graduate school. So they could only go to certain states where their status as parents, that they were both equally recognized as fathers, that they would have employment discriminations if they had a job at a public institution, that they could make sure that benefits would match up with the partner status. This differs state by state, and so it affected their abilities to, you know, go on the job market fully.
We're talking with Stephen Engel. He's associate professor and chair of politics at Bates College, and his new book is Fragmented Citizens: The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives. Now, there are, in several of those topics that we just covered, there is the issue of what is a federal right, what has been granted by certain states, and there are some people that will say this is an issue of states' rights versus federal rights. How would you address that?
Well, I do think that there is a claim, a historical claim, where there, you know, that states' rights is certainly something that we value, because what we're saying is there's a principle in our Constitution of federalism. There are conflicting principles with federalism that are also in our Constitution. The guarantees of equal protection and due process and privileges and immunities of citizenship that follow from the 14th Amendment, I think, are just as strong. And so we have to come up with a way in which what is the balance between those two principles, or in fact, what do we value more? Do we value the way in which states can make decisions, or do we value the notion that if you are a citizen of the United States, then you are guaranteed certain fundamental equal rights as all other citizens of the United States. Taking, as a constitutional law professor at Bates, I take a historical view towards this, and I would argue that the 14th Amendment, coming on the heels of the Civil War, radically transformed the meaning of the Constitution. That if you look at the Bill of Rights, for example, the first 10 amendments, the target of those 10 amendments was really restricting Congress. It was restricting the federal power in favor of the state power. After the Civil War, we see a reversal where we are actually restricting state power in favor and empowering the federal government to protect citizens directly. And I think as a sort of a developmental moment, we have to think about whether or not we've come to a place where citizenship and equal citizenship is perhaps a more valuable principle than states' rights, especially if those states' rights have been used historically as cover for what we would now consider to be discriminatory action.
So we are about a year out from that landmark Supreme Court decision saying that same-sex marriage is legal in the United States. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, in that past year, since then, more anti-LGBTQ bills have been introduced than in any other year in recent history. They count at least 140 state bills introduced across the country, and they anticipate even more next year. This is all while public opinion continues to shift towards greater acceptance. Is there an easy answer for why that is?
Well, I don't think there is an easy answer. I mean, I think that's exactly what I'm trying to explore in the book. I think we tend to view that dynamic of, say, a social movement win, like the Obergefell decision, and then we see a kind of pushback, a politics of counter-movement mobilization. So we might include in those, you know, the past year of legislation, the RFRAs, the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, or something like HB2 out of North Carolina. And I think that while there's something true to that, this is a kind of a social movement and then a kind of counter movement pushback, I think what we're also seeing is that political change in the United States is always partial. So altering laws in one domain raises to the surface tensions with laws and policies in another domain, right? So you have a sort of shift in marriage. And what that suggests is, you know, raises to the surface new inequalities, or it highlights, brings to the fore new inequalities. People stake their positions out on maintaining or trying to dislodge those new inequalities. Like what I was saying earlier, this tension that we now perceive between religious expression and a claim towards equal rights. You know, the canonical case of the wedding cake baker who doesn't want to feel compelled to provide a wedding cake for a same-sex marriage.
We're talking right now with Stephen Engel, author of Fractured Citizens, about the changing landscape of gay and lesbian lives in America and the legal protections he says they still lack.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What's next for the LGBT movement in America? Do you see legalized discrimination against gay and lesbian citizens? And do you think there are changes that need to be made? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking right now with Stephen Engel, professor and chair of politics at Bates College, and author of the book Fragmented Citizens. And we're looking at the challenges faced by LGBT Americans and what hurdles to full equal citizenship, he says, still remain.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What direction do you see the LGBT movement taking next? Do you see legalized discrimination against gay and lesbian citizens at the state or federal level? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And actually, Stephen, we do have a caller on the line. Gary in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. Interesting show. It seems to me that so many gains have been made so fast, and you know, I never hear any gratitude at all, like, thanks, America. I mean, you know, like, we've done a lot here for the LGBTQ plus movement, more than probably any other country, or at least we're doing our best, you know, and it's like, holy cow, you know, marriage has been changed, and that's a jarring thing to a lot of people. Changing the definition of marriage was a big deal. And, you know, so there have been a lot of games. Will there be pushback? Of course there'll be pushback. I mean, until everyone's silent and nods in agreement and hugs all everybody, is that what we need to do? This is America. We're going to have differing views, and I think gay, lesbian, you know, queer, all that stuff have made a lot of gains. So I don't hear any gratitude ever, though. Never. It's always grievances.
All right. Thanks for that call, Gary. And Stephen, how would you respond to that comment?
Well, I think Gary is right that there has been a fair bit of change, but I would question whether or not the change is coming at a pace that is lightning fast, in the sense that we think about the marriage debate as kind of a really radical shift, say in the last 10 years. You know, if we say starting with the Massachusetts decision in 2004 and then Obergefell in 2015, you know, in the span of a decade, that is a pretty radical shift. But I would suggest that, you know, from a historical perspective, the fight for marriage, if we just take that one right, that actually stretches back significantly, at least beginning in the mid 20th century. So these are not short spans of movement mobilization. The LGBT movement has been pushing for equal rights and equal recognitions for quite some time. And I question whether the claim is that the LGBT, those of us who identify as LGBT, should somehow be grateful to the rest of the community for acknowledging that we are, in fact, part of the community. We are citizens. We participate with rights and responsibilities that accord to citizens, and so it is only fair that we are recognized as such. And it is the case, as I pointed out earlier, that equal recognition is not fully there. And I think, in particularly in light of this past weekend shootings in Orlando, I think we're at a very sort of painful and sobering moment in LGBT rights progress. I think what has been revealed is the highly contingent status of what many thought was a steady trend towards equal and dignified recognition. And what Orlando, I think, calls us to reassess both what forward motion should look like for the LGBT movement as we push forward, but it also, I think, reminds us that rights struggles don't necessarily happen in a kind of singular forward or progressive momentum, that, in fact, there is a lot of pushback, as the caller suggested, and that these are sort of long hauls. Despite the rhetoric of the arc of history bends towards justice, that's not necessarily the case. There's a long history in the United States of, the passage, say, for example, of the 14th Amendment, and then 100 years of history where we simply ignore that amendment.
I want to touch on Orlando again, but I also want to bring Mary from Milwaukee in the conversation now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I just want to comment to your last caller that said the LGBT community should be saying thank you. Why? They have the same rights that the rest of us do. I just don't understand that. And I don't think we're progressing in this area anymore. I think we're taking big, huge steps backwards. And I just am appalled.
Well, thank you for that call, Mary. And I think what we see with Mary and Gary both expressing their opinion, Stephen, is that there is still a lot of disagreement and discussion about these topics.
Well, I definitely think that is true. And I think when we ask whether or not there is progress in this area, I would suggest that, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book was I think that no one could deny, and if we bracket the violence in Orlando to one side for a moment, I think no one could deny that there's a particular subset of gay or lesbian individuals, cisgender, white, those with financial means, that the sense of equal treatment under the law has greatly improved for those individuals over the last two decades. But I wonder, and I think we have to think very clearly about what about those in our community who are not cisgender? What about those who are not of a particular financial status or have financial means? What about those queers of color? And what is their level of equality, of their level of equal treatment. I think when we think about what is the next push for the LGBT movement, I think it's quite true that there has been some progress, particularly for particular kinds of gay and lesbian citizens, but a lot more remains ahead.
And just as we prepare to wrap up, in light of that shooting in Orlando, the victims were predominantly gay people of color.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some calls to not use the tragedy for political ends, but others say that everything else in the lives of LGBTQ people gets politicized, so why not something like Orlando? How would you respond to those two positions?
I think that's a very delicate topic. I want to be extraordinarily respectful to the families, the friends, the victims of this horrific shooting. At the same time, I do think that something very valuable can come out of that moment by making a political statement, by saying that maybe it is time once again that pride celebrations that occur throughout this month of June take on a little bit more of a political stand, that, you know, in what we thought was a moment of great celebration because of marriage, for example, the one-year anniversary, that what Orlando demonstrated was that there's so much left to be done, and that maybe it is time to think about pride celebrations as less of commercialized parades and more as political protest movements.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a very interesting and informative discussion.
Thank you. I had a pleasure.
That was Stephen Engel, associate professor and chair of politics at Bates College. He's also an affiliated scholar of the American Bar Foundation. His new book is Fragmented Citizens: The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives.